everybody thinks, what everybody says is real. Today I take a step into a time and space, a peace and possibility. And here I'm gonna stay until I find my place, my true divinity.
Radio and the Occult Network. So please call in with your questions at 646-649-1987. That's 646-649-1987. And if you wish to talk to our guests, have a question or a comment, please don't forget to press on number one so we can get you on the switchboard, and I can take your wonderful questions and comments. And now, having said all of that, without any further ado, let's bring our beloved friend to the forefront. Brian, how are you, my friend?
I'm wonderful, Curtis. Thank you. How about you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. You know, oh, yeah, I'm anxious to hear all the stories, you know, about the elongated skulls, ancient Peruvian history, the Incas, and this upcoming trip that you have planned to Egypt. You know, another place that I plan on visiting very soon. But this is your first time with us, my friend, the first of many appearances, I might add. So before we get into the good stuff, just give us a brief background on yourself and what led you to this stage in your life that made you want to take on the Indiana Jones existence, if you will.
Okay. Well, basically, I grew up in Canada. And when I was 11 years old, my family moved to the West Coast near Vancouver, and I immediately became fascinated by the native culture or cultures of the area, especially the Haida native people, because they were the, or are, the totem pole maker people. And so I immediately started to try carving on my own, and over time I started to meet native carvers who actually started to teach me their, you know, their art form. And that became such a, I wouldn't say obsession, but it became such a love of mine that my university career in biology kind of fell by the wayside after I graduated, and I decided to become a full-time sculptor in the native tradition. And that carried on for a number of years. And then my interest, which was a childhood interest, was in Hawaii, so I started to visit Hawaii, and I met a Hawaiian elder named Auntie Pua Lindsay, and she was, unfortunately she died a few years ago, but she was a member of the royal family, the Ali'i of Maui, and I expressed an interest in participating in the in learning about Hawaiian culture, because there were basically no books available. All of the books seemed to cover Hawaiian history for about five pages, and then Captain Cook would show up, and the rest of the story in the books would be about plantations and pineapples and missionaries. So Auntie Pua steered me towards a man named Keola Sakara, who was rebuilding a large voyaging sailing canoe, and I volunteered on that project, and then he invited me to help him build a larger canoe, double hull, 62 feet long, which was capable of sailing to Tahiti, which is the known place of origin of the Hawaiians. And so I did that, and was fascinated by the Polynesians for a number of years. And then for some reason, I woke up one morning and a little voice inside of my head said Peru. And that 5 years ago led me to here, and I've never been able to leave. More or less.
I see. Yeah, because in a private conversation, you know, I asked you, you know, I was very intrigued by that. You know, I was like, oh, you know, what led you to move to Peru? You know, because I've been looking at, you know, photos of the place, and I've seen several videos about Peru on the internet, and it looks like a beautiful place. You know, what is life like there?
Well, the standard of living is quite economical. Peru is actually, you know, has been, you know, regarded as quote unquote a developing country, but it's becoming quite prosperous now. But it's more the native traditions that fascinate me. What I've ever since I've been a young child, I've seen that the Western world and the Western way of things is quite limited in terms of our ability to basically see the entirety of the world and history around us. And it's always been in the native teachings, no matter where I've been, that I've found such rich wisdom and also acceptance. You know, being basically your standard looking white man. Ever since I was a child, I've been adopted, you know, into Native cultures because they, you know, they, even the elders have told me, we don't look at what, you know, we're not looking at your skin or your face. We're looking at your heart. And that's what, that's what's carried me on. So I was also raised with a, you know, quite a matriarchal mother who came from, you know, came from a prosperous background, but she taught all four of us, her children, that we are no better and we are no different than any other human being on the earth. So never, you know, never think that, you know, never look at another person and judge them based upon what they look like, because they are what you are. You know, you are a human being, and that's what they are. And I thank her very much for that teaching.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it's my dream to have everyone on this beautiful planet adapt that same philosophy. You know, if we could all, you know, adopt that same mindset, then this place will literally change overnight. You know, so I can really appreciate that, you know, and kudos to Mom, because from what you just said, you know, she was a great mom, and she raised her children well. You know, that's why her children are so accomplished, you know. But let's get into the media stuff, you know, because I really like hearing about, you know, archaeology and, you know, and findings, you know, and let's start off talking about the skulls, the elongated skulls. You know, what led you to really, what led you into that path of exploration, and what have you uncovered, you know? So with that, please expound on that, my friend.
Okay, well, basically, it was while I was researching my first, the first book, A Brief History of the Incas, and I wasn't actually writing a book. What happened was I've traveled to, I think, 65 or 70 countries, and it's always been my, you know, the main key for traveling is to see the commonality of humanity. It wasn't just to see big buildings or famous things. It was what makes me similar or the same as the people I'm going to visit, and that's, you know, led me all over the world. But my wife, who's Peruvian, I was, you know, into probably 60 pages of writing what was going to turn out to be a book, and she just told me, she said, well, you seem to know so much about my country, why don't you simply write a book about the Inca? So I said, okay. And we were at a little museum in Cusco, which, you know, was the Inca capital in Peru, and there were these misshapen skulls labeled as being Inca, and I thought, well, that's kind of odd, that because I knew the Inca were a different type of person, a different class of person than most of the people, but the fact that they seemed to be physically different fascinated me. And then I found out through my research that the ancestors of the Inca were most probably from Tiwanaku, which is on the south side of Lake Titicaca. And again, excavations have unearthed these elongated skulls. And so I thought, well, obviously genetically there's something going on here. And it's just kind of snowballed from there. The most amazing ones are in a small museum in a little town called Ica. And they're the largest elongated skulls in the world. Most people think that all of the elongated skulls were created by a religious sect in many different parts of the world, but that they were physically bound in order to alter the shape of the skull. But that's only the case in some. The Ica Museum has examples of skulls whose volume is at least twice that of a modern human being's. And so that means that their brain was probably twice that of what we have. And from that, I've been able to interact with people such as David Hatcher Childress, you know, who's quite a famous author, and he is the real Indiana Jones, by the way, but also other other very, very influential people like Graham Hancock, who I write a monthly article for, and Stephen Mailer, who's an expert on, amongst other things, the crystal skulls of the world, but also he's an independent Egyptologist. And through him to some degree, but others I found, you know, it seems that Akhenaten, for example, you know, the Egyptian pharaoh, may have had a naturally elongated skull. So what I've been doing is researching to find out the timeline of when these elongated skull people lived and the possible genetic relationships between different groups in different parts of the world.
Ah, I see. Excellent, excellent. Because, yeah, usually when I look at things like this, you know, I'm always looking at the History Channel and the Discovery Channel, and I've always been fascinated, you know, about ancient cultures, because I'm always trying to bridge the gap, you know, of the past to the present. And, you know, when, you know, prior to this show, you know, when I was looking over your website, and especially when you pointed out to me that you wanted to discuss that this evening, you know, when I Googled the elongated skulls, you know, all I could say was, wow. You know, I was like, this is really interesting. I really have to really pay more attention to this. You know, so basically when you began this area of exploration and we talk about the skulls. Now, usually when we talk about skulls, that's it's obviously, you know, remnants of who used to be or what used to be. You know, what would you say, you know, when you discovered these skulls, is there a specific race or civilization that they trace back to? Do they have anything to do with ancient Peruvian history or ancient Egyptian history? You know, where do they come from? What do these skulls represent? What civilization or race did they represent from your discovery?
Well, the most amazing thing is the common theme seems to be whether it's people in Melanesia, as in the island of Vanuatu, or whether it's the Amara culture, who were the pharaohs in Egypt, as in Akhenaten and Tutankhamun, who was his son, of course, but then also in Peru and the Olmecs, and also the island of Malta. The common theme seems to be that as a ritual undertaking of binding the skulls or flattening them using boards, that this was restricted only to the priestly kingly class, which could have been exactly the same thing, of course. You know, in some cultures, there was such an enmeshment of the elite that they were both, you know, the priests and the I wouldn't call them overlords, but overseers. And so what they were attempting to do, and this was up until the last century, was they wanted these children to look physically like the ancestors. And that's the common theme, is we want the children to look like the ancestors. So, of course, the question is, who were these ancestors? And many people, of course, point to the possibility of the original ones being alien hybrids. And the star system, which is most commonly thought of, is the Sirius star system, or to some degree, the Pleiades. But the most intriguing thing that I've found is, and it seems to only be in Peru, on the coast of Peru, around the Paracas area, which is south of Lima, that there's evidence of naturally shaped elongated skulls, and the largest ones in the world are from there. And these skulls have a number of different characteristics which make them... I'm not going to use the term alien, but it makes them not average human beings. And what I've done is, amazingly enough, no one's ever done DNA analysis. So I was able, through a small museum in Paracas run by Senior Juan Navarro, he allowed me to take DNA samples from five of the skulls he has, and I sent them to Lloyd Pye, who you might know of in terms of he's the keeper of the Starchild skull. And
oh,
so Lloyd,
yes.
Right,
oh,
now, Yeah. Well, Lloyd was very excited when I contacted him, and so he has the samples now, and his geneticist is about to study them as we speak.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, I followed Lloyd's work for quite some time. You know, I've learned a lot from Lloyd. You know, his scholarship is extraordinary. And you also mentioned two others, Stephen Mailer and Graham Hancock, who've also been on the show. You know, Stephen Mailer is a good friend of mine. I enjoy Stephen. You know, you keep good company there, Brian. Yeah, you definitely keep good company there. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Oh, well, I'm very fortunate that Stephen and I hit it off. I think it's only a month ago or something. But I was given his number and called him on Skype, and his first reaction when he saw my face is he said, "Oh, there you are." You know, it's almost like he was Obi-Wan Kenobi. It's quite funny, but he and I talk at least once a week, and it's like stream of consciousness thinking. And we always talk for at least an hour, and it just goes all over the planet. So he's a great great scholar and I would call him a wise elder, who is steeped very much in the oral traditions of the ancient Phoenician people, who were the dynastic pre-Pharaoh people of Egypt, thanks to his teacher Hakim. And the history of Egypt is something I'm just getting into, but it is absolutely astonishing once you get past the Egyptologists and all of their falsehoods and their, you know, lies or misconceptions about the past. Egypt is the most amazing place in terms of history.
Oh, yes, indeed. You know, which leads us, into our next question. You know, tell us a little bit. You have a trip coming up to Egypt, you know, and, please tell us what you're going to be doing there, you know, because I haven't been to Egypt yet. You know, I'm in the process of planning to go. So anyone who's been there or planning to go there, you know, they automatically get my attention. You know, because I've been studying a place for so long, you know, without having, you know, ever been there, you know, so when I hear people say, oh, I'm getting ready to go to Egypt, you know, I'm immediately, you know, fascinated. So, tell us about what this trip that you have coming up to Egypt and what you're going to be doing there.
Okay, well, basically, I've tried to stay away from learning too much about Egypt because I've never wanted to be somebody who can speak about many different cultures around the planet. I've been trying to focus specifically on where it is that I am, because I'd rather know a lot about one area than a little about a lot of them. But I haven't been able to help myself because, thanks to Stephen, amongst other people, but I've been given the opportunity through Antoine Jigal, who's been studying in Egypt for more than 20 years, and also Jan-Peter de Jong, who spent 13 years in Cusco studying the pre-Inca stone constructions here. And basically, the two of them thought that it would be interesting if Jan-Peter and I, who know, I suppose you could say, a fair bit about pre-Inca stone construction, if we were to go to Egypt and see what structures we saw there that were, you know, very similar to structures that we see in Peru. And basically both are pointing to pre-Ice Age or pre-flood, very sophisticated cultures. So what we're going to try to do is see if we can find evidence that the people of ancient Kemetia, as it was called, or Kemet, K-E-M-E-T, if they were in contact with the pre-Inca people, 10,000, maybe even 20,000 years ago. And the main misconception that most people who visit Peru have is that the Inca were the only major culture, and through my research, I found that to be far, you know, very much not the case. The Inca were the, basically, and excuse the pun, the pinnacle of the pyramid, but there are many other cultures, some which are very esoteric and ancient in nature, who were responsible for the major megalithic constructions that present-day archaeologists claim the Inca have made. But the Inca themselves, if you read the ancient chronicles and even the early Spanish accounts, the Inca admitted that they didn't build, you know, the ones that, you know, the giant stone blocks that fit perfectly. They themselves said, we didn't do that. That was made by others that came before us.
Wow, interesting. Interesting. You know, I mean, a lot of these, you know, this information is really coming out, you know, and this is stuff that I've really taken an interest, you know, from following your work and Hugh Newman's work, you know, who, by the way, is going to be our guest tomorrow. And as you said, Stephen and then Graham. And, you know, what, the more I follow your work and Hugh's work and Stephen's work, it really sucks me in. You know, and this is information that I really would like to get out to the masses, because it really helps us to really bridge the gap, you know, because I've always been a big fan of history, you know, because when I found that when one studies history, it enables you to really understand what's going on in front of you right now. You know, so that's why I can really appreciate this information. But you've also involved in some interesting projects as well, Brian. And, you know, I've been, the past several days, I've been back and forth over your website. And I went to the project section as well as the photos section. You know, as a matter of fact, I've added many of those photos to my personal collection because they're absolutely beautiful. But one of the things that jumped out at me on the website was something called the Shipibo spirit, you know, dealing with jewelry. Oh, yeah. You know, and I was like, oh, yes, I immediately wrote it down. I have to get Brian to talk about this at length because that jewelry is beautiful. So please, you know, tell us more about the Shipibo spirit.
Okay, well, the Shipibo people are the indigenous people of the Amazon basin, Amazon rainforest, in the central area of Peru, near the town called Pucallpa. And the thing is that many of your listeners and many people in general are becoming more and more aware of ayahuasca, which is a native medicine which comes and is the traditional medicine of these people. Soon after my first trip to Peru, or my second, my fiance at the time, we met with a husband and wife who live in a, I guess you would call, a shanty town in Lima, and we got on so well with them that they are artisans, and they're not, you know, financially doing very well. And as we learn more and more about the plight of their people, because being in the Amazon, unfortunately, the Amazon in Peru, you know, it's not just Brazil, but Peru and Ecuador and other countries in the area are the rainforest is under threat, not simply from deforestation, but also from oil and gold and natural gas exploit. You know, I wouldn't call it mining. I call it exploitation. And it's being conducted by foreign companies in general. And I don't mind naming the countries. The countries are England and Canada and the United States are the ones who are responsible in general for this, with the help of the Peruvian government. Yeah, so one experience I did have was on one of my first trips to Cusco. I suppose you could say I was at a crossroads in my life, and so I met a wonderful shaman who is a friend of mine, and he's a Shipibo as well, and his name is Jesus Morello, and he conducted an ayahuasca session for me, which was completely transformative in my life. And I've been through many Native American and Hawaiian rituals and things, but this was so profound in that it was the first time that I understood that the medicine itself, it was of such a strength that after my ceremony, it continues to speak to you, and it told me, I've done this for you, I've opened your mind, now go and help my people. So the next day I flew to Pucallpa and went to where the people are from, and started to buy some of their seed jewelry, more or less as gifts for my fiance at the time. And she and I have developed a little business now where it isn't simply fair trade. We buy directly from them and sell directly to people in the United States and Canada and Europe who wish to support these native people who have basically zero governmental help. And that's basically the story.
I see. And you also have an agency where you take people on guided tours of these ancient Incan sites as well. You know, tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, that's true. That's my website is hiddenincatours.com. And on the home page of that, you will see a basic breakdown of all of the activities that my wife and I have been doing and things that are coming up. You did mention Hugh Newman, and that's fortuitous in that Hugh and I are going to be having a large tour through his Megalithomania company and my Hidden Inca Tours company in November from the 10th to the 20th, showing people all of the major megalithic sites around Lake Titicaca and Cusco and the Sacred Valley. We've been doing tours, but what we try to stress is that we're not a tour company. We're more it's more of an exploratory company, and what we hope is that the people who come with us wish to be part of the, part of the research as we go. Because we very much like to dispel a lot of the myths that a lot of the tour guides tell about Cusco. For example, the average tour guide in Cusco will tell you that the Inca built everything there, which is completely unfounded. There are two cultures that predated the Inca, one of them probably 10,000 years before them, and another one possibly 20,000 years, and they were the megalithic builders. So in April, we had a wonderful trip with the crew from Ancient Aliens, who came here to film season 3, 4 episodes of that series. And so originally we were hired to coordinate them and find hotels and the right sites to show, but I got along very well with the director Dave, and so Dave decided to put me on camera, and so I'm actually in 4 episodes.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow,
that was fun.
I look forward to that. And when I was looking at that website as well, and one of the things that jumped out at me was the shamanic tools, and I was like, I had no idea that the Incans had such a history. Tell us a little bit about their shamanic history, because when I was looking at the tools there that they used, it was very interesting. Of course, this being occult science radio and me being fascinated with the occult, and esoteria, that I really began to focus in on that. So share with us, a little bit about their history, relative to this area.
Well, what is basically known is that the Inca came from the area of Lake Titicaca, either the Island of the Sun or Tiwanaku, or Tiwanaku, depending on how you want to call it. But Tiwanaku is probably where they came from, and that place is very mysterious in that conventional scholarship, believes that Tiwanaku was built about 300 or begun about 300 BC, but there was a researcher, Bolivian one, called Arthur Poznanski, and Graham Hancock is the one who's done the majority of the work that I've accessed on this. And Poznanski speculated through the use of what's called the obliquity of the ecliptic, which is the measurement of the position of the sun relative to the Earth and the orbit, that Tiwanaku was 12 to 15,000 years old. And that completely destroyed his career simply by saying that. But the Inca, the amazing thing about the Inca is that they showed up in the Secret Valley and Cusco either in the 1100s or 1200s AD as a completely fully functioning society. They had mastered all of the arts. They had mastered the arts of government and of warfare, and they just seemed to have suddenly shown up, and there were people living in Cusco, and the Inca just said, "We're here, and we've come to organize your lives." Over the course of, since, you know, from their arrival about, again, say 1100 to 1200, up until the Spanish conquest, which began in 1532, they became the largest civilization in all of the Americas. And what I'm just finishing a book about that that I'm writing right now about that period of history. And the most amazing thing about the Inca was they are wrongly portrayed as being this, you know, massive warrior culture that, you know, ground other nations into the earth. And that's not true. They actually, they tried as much as possible to peacefully envelop other nations and other cultures. And the Inca civilization, because I hate the term empire, the civilization was more of a confederation than it was an empire. The supreme or high Inca was in charge, you know, was in charge because he was the sun, you know, regarded as divine, being the son of the sun. But they only used warfare and force when they had to. And that's something that most history books do not write about. They portray them as being a very ruthless and bloodthirsty people, and and performed human sacrifice, which also is completely untrue.
Well, you and I both know that such is the way of Hollywood. They're often given to, you know, sensationalize things. So we have to expect that of them, you know, because they have to make it entertaining. But this is what makes, people like yourself, people like Hugh Newman and Stephen and Graham so necessary, because then you could, tell us to pay no mind to what's going on in Hollywood and give us the truth, you know. So this is what makes you guys so necessary. And Nazca, you know, and the ancient aliens. You know, I've read that when I was going over, you know, the Tor website. You know, that really jumped out at me, you know, because I'd never heard of that before. So, yes, please, definitely, you know, expound on that, because that seems to be very interesting.
Nazca?
Yes, and the ancient aliens.
Okay, well, well, with the Ancient Aliens crew and Ancient Aliens, the series has become the number one hit on the History Channel. Supposedly, in season two, over 100 million people from around the world watched it. Because people have this inherent questioning of where did we come from, and because there are so many unexplicable or inexplicable things on the earth that seem to be either of human making or otherworldly making, that show is naturally popular. So we went, we spent quite a bit of time in Cusco and the area, but then we also went to Nazca and to Paracas, which is west of Nazca on the coast. And it was during the filming that we did in Nazca that I was able to talk with one of the local archaeologists. And that was quite revealing because, as you may know, with the Nazca lines, there are the lines themselves, and then there are also the animal figures. And most people have a tendency to think that the Nazca people themselves made all of it. But what's important to stress is the fact that just because a certain civilization lives in a certain area doesn't mean that they or their ancestors have always been there, and it doesn't mean that they have all, you know, that they were responsible for everything that's there. The Great Pyramids in Egypt being the classic examples of that, but that's, you know, that's getting off topic. But in terms of the Nazca lines, what I learned is that the Paracas culture, again going back to these people or beings with very elongated skulls, they lived on the coast of Peru, but they also lived inland in the area that we now call Nazca, and it seems highly likely that they were the makers of the animal figures first, probably at least 3,000 years ago. And the most famous one of their figures that they made is the one called the astronaut, which is on the side of a hill. And it was after the Paracas people, who were very small in population, began to mix and blend in with the Nazca people, that the long-headed or long-skulled characteristics began to recede, because there, you know, through the generations there was more Nazca DNA than Paracas DNA. So eventually, about the year or the time of Christ, the Nazca were all that, you know, all that were left. The Paracas were gone as a culture, and the Nazca people were the ones responsible for the lines. So the lines came after the animal figures. And what is most likely, you know, people talk about they would, you know, landing strips or this, that, or whatever, but it's more probable that the Nazca, because it's such a desert area, the Nazca had to figure out where their water supply was coming from, which was always underground. So I think the most logical idea is the lines, to some degree at least, represent the aquifers that travel underneath the ground, and they made the lines in order to, you know, to mark a path just in case one of the aquifers decided not to work, they could, you know, explore on the ground itself as to other options to grow their food, because being such a desert climate without, you know, they get zero rainfall. If they didn't have this water, that would be the end of them.
I see. You know, and you've also done a lot of research, and, you know, even I have written a book about it on Hawaii and their
yes.
ancient past. Yes, you know, please, you know, spend as much time, because that is such a gorgeous place. You know, and so please tell us of your findings relative to Hawaii and their history, because I'm interested to know more about their history, you know, as well. So please, you know, tell us what you've discovered about Hawaii. I'm really interested, and it's probably the listeners as well. You know, I can tell from the response that they're interested in hearing more about that as well.
Okay, well, my love of Hawaii has been since I was a very small child, because my parents used to go leave the, you know, the god-awful winter weather of Canada to go to Hawaii, and I was always jealous, so I finally blackmailed them when I was 12 to take my brother and I, and my brother wanted to go scuba diving, and all I wanted to do was learn about the Hawaiians, but unfortunately, there was very little information available, and still, up to this day, it's still very difficult to find too much written material, especially from the Hawaiian perspective. You know, you'll get university reports, or, you know, there are almost innumerable books written about the legends, but in order to learn the origins of where the Hawaiians came from, and the story of their at least 2,000 years of existence in those islands, I wouldn't say required me to spend time with Hawaiian elders. I was just very fortunate that Auntie Pua Lindsay adopted me and some of the other elders. Because I was involved in this cultural Hawaiian project, I showed my heart was, you know, was there. And so they opened themselves up and were just, you know, over the course of time, tell me stories about you know, just certain things. What's, you know, what is known in general is that the Hawaiians came in two distinct migrational waves. The conventional view is that the first Hawaiians came possibly or probably from the Marquesas Islands about the time, again, I use the time of Christ because I still like the, you know, the BC AD concept, not that I'm a Christian, but I just, you know, I find that simpler to work with. And then the second wave of Hawaiians came about the year 1200 from Tahiti. And I wrote my book because these elders had told me these stories and more or less, you know, told me that it was okay with them that I repeat them as long as I was correct in the way that I, you know, wrote things, like wrote their traditions down. But what isn't known is that the first Hawaiian people were very, you know, they're very tall, you know, tall, strong people, but they were very peaceful people. And that's where the whole concept probably and philosophy of aloha comes from. They were very tied to the, you know, to the land in terms of a harmonic relationship and also with the ocean. And about the year 1200, these warriors came from Tahiti, and they brought with them, in the form of stones, they brought the four dominant gods, which were Kane, Kanaloa, Lono, and Ku. And these people took, or the Tahitians brutally took over the Hawaiian Islands and more or less wiped out the first people. And the interesting thing is that some of the elders will tell you that the first people were called the Mu, as in the lost continent of Mu. And that really, really intrigued me. But in modern, like with modern tourists who go there, they'll hear stories about these characters called the Menahuni, who are written about as these small, almost leprechaun type characters. But according to the oral tradition, the Menahuni were the first Hawaiians. It's just that the Tahitians, in their way of domination, ridiculed these people so much that they made up stories and said they were small. And actually, Menahuni comes from a more proper term, which is, I believe, Manahuna, which means people of small power. And it's because these Manahuna or Mu people were peaceful that it was easy for the Tahitians to dominate them.
I see. Now, I notice you also have some information, you know, on your site about Atlantis. Now, for the past couple of years, you know, I've been caught in the middle. You know, there's, you know, and I've developed an interest in it myself, you know, because it's been information, there's too much information out there on it. On one side, I'm hearing that some people say, oh, well, Atlantis is a myth. It never existed. But then on the other side, there are those that are saying that Atlantis is real. You know, it did exist. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, I'm hearing both sides. And so that's why, you know, when I talk to people like yourself, you know, I said, well, let me ask them, you know, so we can get the truth here, you know, rather than just going back and forth. You know, please tell us your findings, you know, about Atlantis. Is it real or is it myth?
Well, that's according to according to David Hatcher Childress, Atlantis is the most written about subject in the history of humanity.
Just
so there's so many, there's so many theories out there. One thing that does kind of sound to me that makes sense though is that if you take into account that oral traditions in general, no matter where you go in the world, are poetic in nature. They tell a story, and they tell factual evidence, but they do it in an artistic, poetic kind of way. Just so, you know, so that it's more interesting to pass down and to learn about than just, you know, raw facts and figures. So, as an example, less about Atlantis and more about Mu or Lemuria is the fact that when they talk about a continent or a landmass sinking, that could in fact be poetry. And what it might mean is it may very well refer to the end of the Ice Age, when the ocean level rose by between 300 and 400 feet. And so what would have happened in, for example, a place like Hawaii, was during the Ice Age, the islands of Maui, Molokai, Lanai, and Koho'olawe were all one island. But after the sea level rose, that caused the separation of the islands. And so from a figurative or poetic viewpoint, that would be the land sinking. It didn't physically sink. The opposite happened. The ocean rose. So I believe in terms of Atlantis that it was the same phenomenon. I don't think a continent sank, but I think Atlantis itself was a global culture, probably centered somewhere off the Canary, you know, maybe the Canary Islands, or maybe also in the Mediterranean. But after the end of the Ice Age, because the sea level rose by 300 to 400 feet, then figuratively the continent sank. And that is part of the pursuit now with the connections between Peru and Egypt that we're looking at is we're looking at connections before the end of the so-called Ice Age.
I see. Wow. Time really flew, you know, unfortunately. But, yes, I'm already, Brian, I'm already planning your next visit. So when you go on this trip with you and you go to your Egyptian trip, make sure you take a lot of notes, because you're going to be right back here on Occult Science Radio telling us all about it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay. Yes, we definitely look forward to having you again. But just take a moment or two, my friend, to let everyone know what you got going on now, what you have coming up, and how you can be reached, and how we can also take advantage of the wonderful tours that you offer.
Okay, thank you. My website is hiddenincatours.com, and my website isn't simply a tour company, it's a resource base. So I have accessible on there almost 500 YouTube videos, which I've personally taken, mainly around Peru, as well as hundreds of photographs. And the homepage or the front page is especially important because it lists all of the different trips that are coming up and activities. The two main ones that are coming are, again, the Megalithomania trip in November from the 10th to the 20th with a four-day extension to go to Nazca. And that's with Hugh Newman. And also David Hatcher-Childress is going to be on that with us. And then the other one is with Antoine Jigal, the trip to Egypt, with Jan-Peter de Jong, and that's from the 28th of January to February the 5th. I'm also writing or co-authoring a book with David Childress right now about the global phenomenon of the elongated skull enigma. And if you want to go on YouTube and look at my 400 and I think it's 76 videos, most of them are quite short because they give little snippets of information about a lot about the Inca, but also various other places. It's my name, BrienFoerster. If you just put those two names together in the search box, then you'll find my videos. And I'm also, I believe I was saying that I'm writing a book about the actual Inca period now. And my four books that I've already written are all available as ebooks. And again, you can see that on the front page of my website. And my Brief History of the Incas book is in print, and that's available exclusively through David Hatcher-Childress's Adventures Unlimited Press, which again also is on the homepage of my website.
Hmm. My friend, it was a pleasure.
Go ahead. Thank you very much, Curtis.
Yes, indeed. Like I said, when you go on these trips, make sure you take a lot of notes because, you know, we're friends. We communicate a lot on Skype now. So most definitely, you know, we're going to have you right back here on Occult Science Radio and possibly even before and definitely after when you come back because then you're going to have all that much more to share with us.
Oh, yes, definitely. And thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here with us, my friend. And once again, like I said, I'm already planning your next visit. Thank you so much, and be well, my good friend. Look forward to having you again.
Thank you, Brother Curtis.
Take care, my friend. And I also want to thank you all as well, beloved family, for taking time out of your busy schedules as well to be here with us on Occult Science Radio. Definitely tune in tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we will have Brian's good friend, Hugh Newman, who will be joining us tomorrow to also share his tremendous adventures and career with us as well. So you definitely want to mark your calendar and tune in for that one as well. So thank you all very much, and as I always say to my beloved family out there, peace, love, and power. And please, please, walk with strength. Peace.
Higher consciousness. Let's go higher in our consciousness.
Let's go higher.
Let's go higher.
no longer again.